Well, good evening, everyone. A few faces here that I don't know, so it's nice to meet you for the first time. The question that I want to look at tonight is, seriously, who made the Bible? And I think that for us, that this is a question that you may not realise is being answered in our society, but it is being answered in a number of ways around us. So there are documentaries on TV which will talk about how the Bible was put together. It's mentioned in the Da Vinci Code. There are big sections in the Da Vinci Code as to how this book was put together. And it may be a question that you've even asked yourself. Maybe you're a Christian, you've grown up in a Christian home. How did the Bible come about? Where did it come from even? I'm not exactly sure. It just sort of comes from a long time ago. But in order to answer this, I need to ask something else, and that is, actually, what is the Bible? And that's where I want to start tonight, because the Bible is a unique book. In fact, it's not just one book. For those of you who are Christians, you would probably know that there are different books within the Bible. There's what we call the Law of Moses. There's the Psalms of David. There's the books of Proverbs from Solomon. There's the Gospels from Jesus' disciples. But this is the first thing we need to realize about the Bible, that it is, in fact, a collection of many books. 66 books, in fact. And so the question as to who made it has got to do with this putting together of a number of books. When we actually look at what's in the Bible, we see that there are over 40 different authors. It's a little hard to know the exact number, but it's around that number, around 40. As Christians, we consider them to be prophets who spoke from God, but there's about 40 of them, and they spoke over a 1,500-year period. So from the time of Moses right through to the time of Jesus. And so this is something about the Bible we need to understand. It's an inclusive book. I think people often think Christianity is exclusive and keeps people out, but when we actually come to the Bible, the question that we have here is, how did books get included into it? There is an exclusion, but there's also an awful lot of inclusion. Over 1,500 years by a large number of prophets being put together in this one book. Now, as I said before, the question we're looking at tonight is, seriously, who made the Bible? And I want to look at the emphasis now on this idea of seriously, because often this is put forward to us as an accusation, isn't it? It's put forward in the worst possible way, really. So there are documentaries, which I got this from the ABC Bookshop, and I watched it, and it's called Who Wrote the New Testament? And basically, it reads like a conspiracy, that there are these secret groups, and books are being put in, and things are being excluded, and things are being hidden. And that's the type of thing you'll get at SBS and the ABC Bookshop. There is, of course, as I mentioned before, the Da Vinci Code. I actually met some people the other day who didn't know about the Da Vinci Code, so maybe that's even passing on. But it was a very popular book in sort of the last 5 or 6 years ago. And it had a big section in there about how Constantine, the Roman Emperor, made the Bible. And it was from his point on that Jesus became God in the Christian belief. And it was all the conspiracy and the enforcement of the official church. And so I guess for many of us, that's what we're dealing with when we talk to people about the Bible, there's this scepticism. There's this background noise that's just in the documentaries all the time, in the novels that you read. It's almost just like an assumption that you should be sceptical about this book. So you're not really sceptical about the Quran, you're not really sceptical about the teaching of Buddha, you're not really sceptical about Aristotle's teaching, but you are sceptical about the Bible because, by and large, in our culture, you've been trained to be sceptical about it. Now, what I'm wanting to do tonight is just to try to look at it as objectively as I can, and we'll have questions at the end, and just look at really two questions that I particularly want to look at. Where did the different parts or the different books come from, and how were they put together? What was that inclusion and exclusion process of putting them together? I'm only going to be looking at part of the Bible because of time. Come on in. I'm only going to be looking at part of the Bible because of time, and I'm going to be looking at what's called the New Testament section, which is the part that mainly speaks about Jesus in an overt type of way. I'm only doing that because of time. We could equally ask that of the Old Testament, but because of the limits of this one talk, I'll just look at the New Testament. So the two questions, where did the books or the different parts come from? How were the books put together? And I've actually got a third part we're going to look at. We're going to look at an example of a rejected book. So the Gospel of Thomas was one of the books that didn't make it into the Bible, and we're going to have a look at it and do a test case, put it into practice to see how we work that out. Okay, so let's look at the first part then. Where did the different parts come from? Well, for the New Testament, I want to argue that it started with Jesus, because Jesus was a teacher. Jesus was a teacher. And he taught people in such a way that they found him engaging, they found him memorable, they found him someone that they wanted to follow. And that is just a part of general history. There have been other teachers. Christians are not saying Jesus is the only teacher who's ever existed. We're not saying that. We're saying, no, Jesus was, for us, a very significant teacher of the first century, but there were others. But because there are others, when we see Jesus teaching and having followers, that's actually quite a normal thing. That Jesus would be a teacher with disciples is actually normal. It's what you'd expect. It's what the rabbis around Jesus' time did. You can read there how Jesus spoke. He said, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'Do not murder.' But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment." And so Jesus spoke as a man of authority. When he's quoting the phrase there, "Do not murder," that comes from a famous part of the Bible called the Ten Commandments that you may have heard of. And there is Jesus quoting a very famous part saying, "You've heard this, but I tell you this." And so you can see the authority that Jesus is claiming in his teaching there. Now, he not only taught large crowds, but as we read through the accounts of his life, we see that he also taught his disciples personally. So he had a public ministry, but he also had a more personal ministry to a smaller group of disciples. And again, this is not unusual. This would be normal for a teacher to do. Jesus also commissioned his disciples to teach and to pass on his teaching. Have a look at Matthew 28, verse 19 and 20 there. It says, "Therefore go and make disciples of all nations, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you." Now, how did his disciples do this? Well, they did it the way that people normally did it. That was through preaching, through proclaiming the message, through writing it, through passing on the stories of Jesus. The disciples were also teachers from the beginning. You see, we often hear about these disciples and we hear about them being teachers and doing things. Why do you appoint teachers? You appoint teachers because you're going to be passing something on. And that's what we find here with the disciples. The disciples were Jesus' students. They're eyewitnesses to what he did. They were taught by him. And it's not that at some time later, 50 years after Jesus, people said, "Oh, let's start writing up the life of Jesus. I remember Jesus. Remember him back then? Oh, what was he on about?" And so it wasn't like that. Jesus himself was a teacher. He had students. He sent his students out to teach what he was on about. So it wasn't something that came much later on. Now, again, what I've just said there is actually very normal. That's what Buddha did hundreds of years before Jesus. That's what he did. He was a teacher. He had his disciples, and they spread Buddhism. That's what Muhammad did 600 years after Jesus. He was a teacher. He had his disciples, and they took it. Muhammad's disciples took it in a different way to Jesus, but they still took out his message. And so there is no reason to be skeptical that Jesus was a teacher who had disciples who passed on his teaching. I know this might sound really, really basic, but as I said, when it comes to Christianity, we just have this inbuilt skepticism of, we have no connection to him. He couldn't have had any students. It couldn't have happened this way. What I've just outlined to you is the most simple, reasonable, historically verifiable way that it did happen. And so it may not sound like much what I've just said, but I'm just trying to say, it was quite normal and human what happened. That he was a teacher, had students, and they passed on his teaching. Again, I say that because we're not sceptical of Buddhism, we're not sceptical of Islam, we're not sceptical of other Jewish rabbis, but in our culture, there's just this deep suspicion of Jesus. And I want to challenge you, are you just suspicious of anything with Jesus? Are you saying that he couldn't even be a normal teacher? If your skepticism, if you've been taught by your skepticism to say that Jesus couldn't even be a normal teacher, then I think you've been deceived, and you've just got to realise what we're dealing with here. Now, how did his disciples spread Jesus' message? Well, they did it a few ways, as I said. One was by writing letters. And so within the New Testament, part of the Bible, we have a number of letters written from an apostle, a disciple of Jesus, to one or many churches. Or sometimes they would tell the stories of Jesus, but not just tell them as we would tell them, but tell them in terms of oral tradition. So I'll give you some examples of oral tradition. So too many cooks spoil the broth. People heard that one before? Too many cooks have spoiled the broth. Okay. Many hands make light work. Now see, we've never actually written that down, have we? But there's actually an oral tradition within our community of certain things that we say. And if I said to you, many hands make heavy work, you'd say, no, you've got that wrong. Now, it's not that you've read it, it's just that there's an oral tradition. Now, back in this day, oral tradition was up here and written was much more down here. The written was still very important, but the oral tradition was much larger than it is for us today. Whereas we may only have a few things that are within our oral tradition, for them, a lot of things were in oral tradition. And so the disciples of Jesus, yes, they wrote letters, but they also told the stories of Jesus in such a way that it was like many hands make light work. That was how they taught it, in many hands make light work type way. You understand what I'm saying there? So it's different to how you think, but it's just how they lived in their technology, their degree of literacy. The oral traditions were very important. And those oral traditions, they came in time to be known as what we call the gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, through a process that we have some idea about. But let's have a look at these letters first of all. So I've got a couple of quotes here for you. This is from the Apostle Peter. And it says, Peter, an apostle, so it'll be on that sheet there in front of you, hopefully, under the letters. You can see that they were sent to whole regions and to be read by other churches. And it reads, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to God's elect, strangers in the world, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Now that's modern-day Turkey. So the apostle Peter sent his letter to a whole, what we would call a whole country, the whole of modern-day Turkey. And it did the rounds being passed on. Have a look at what the Apostle Paul says at the end of his letter to the church in a city called Colossae. He says, after this letter has been read to you, see that it is read in the church of the Laodiceans, and that you in turn read the letter from Laodicea. So you see how the apostles were not just sending these letters to churches, but there's instructions to pass them around between each other. And so we have this from the letters themselves. Now, again, the reason they did that was that they were being teachers, and this is what teachers did. They gave their teaching, and they said, pass the teaching around. So again, this is quite normal that we're looking at with what we're looking at here. Now, as I've said, the Gospels are the testimonies to Jesus' life. They're the written form of the writings of the apostles mixed with this oral tradition. And what the disciples are actually doing in writing these accounts is not actually new in a sense. They're sort of continuing their religion. These were Jewish men and they already had the idea of holy writings. And in fact, if you read in 2 Kings chapter 4, it almost feels like you're reading something from the New Testament. It has a prophet going here, doing this, and it feels very similar to what you have in the gospel accounts. And so again, the disciples are not even doing something particularly new at this point. It's continuing the tradition of the holy writings that they'd received as Jews from the scriptures that were before them. And in many ways, that's what you'd expect them to do. So again, I just want us to not be skeptical here, but to look at how reasonable this is. There are teachers sending out letters and teaching, asking it to be passed around. The disciples of Jesus are writing up the life of their master in a type of genre that is that was already with them from their own scriptures. I'm not saying it's not completely new. I'm not saying it's not unique in any way, but I'm saying that there are similarities. And so again, there's no need to be skeptical that his disciples would actually do this. There's no grounds for being skeptical. Now, how did the apostles themselves understand their writing? And this is where we can look at the apostles' writings themselves. We're going to be looking at tomorrow the question of, is the Bible history? And I want you to imagine if you were to write the history of one of your friends, the way you might do it would be to maybe get some of their emails or go to their Facebook page and look at what they've done and then write up your history. Well, a lot of what's in the Bible is actually the letters that historians go to write up the history. So it's not just that the Bible's history, some of it's not history, it's in fact better than history. It's the letters that you would go to work out what somebody thought it. And that's what we find here. And so we can see what the apostles themselves were thinking of themselves. Have a look at these two references here under how did the apostles understand their preaching and writing. It says, Paul, called to be an apostle of Christ Jesus by the will of God. And Peter, an apostle of Christ, of Jesus Christ. Now the word apostle here is a term for one who is sent with authority. So it's like saying that you're a statesman, that you're an ambassador. It's that type of word. Have a look at how John introduces himself. He says, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched. Now he's speaking about Jesus there. He's saying Jesus was from the beginning. We've seen him, we've heard him, we've touched him. This we proclaim to you concerning the word of life. You see, that they saw themselves as authoritative people from Jesus. And what they said was binding on Christians. Have a look at how Paul writes. He says, what I am writing to you is the Lord's command. If anyone ignores this, he himself will be ignored. So when we just look at the letters of the apostles, when we look at what they wrote to the churches, and just looking at how they understood themselves, I'm not even asking you to believe that they had this authority, but this is how they understood themselves. They said that they are the ones who have been sent from Jesus, and that they are speaking on his behalf, and that how they speak is binding on Christians. They're passing on the authoritative teaching of Jesus, and for the church, this is binding. Now, just to conclude that small section there, we see that the authority of these writings is not something that people have later imposed back on it. It's not that we've just taken some writings and gone, we'll make these writings authoritative. When you actually go and read the documents themselves, they're claiming this authority. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that people later on may not have made that decision, but I am saying that when you look at the documents, they're actually saying, we are the authoritative spokesman from Jesus. That's who we are. And what we're saying is to be binding on the church. So it's not a later development that's being imposed back on them. It is something that is there in them. It's not that the church gave these documents authority. The authority was something that the apostles claimed themselves. And we'll come back to this a bit later on. And again, there's no reason to doubt that. There's no reason to doubt that these men would be making those types of claims if they've come from Jesus. Now, how did the early church respond to the to this teaching? Well, we read in the Bible that the early Christians devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching. And we also read that this teaching was something that was to be passed on for the future. And that the disciples, that the apostles of Jesus themselves made preparation for this. So we read here in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, the apostle Paul writes, and the things you have heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to reliable men who will also be qualified to teach others. So here's the Apostle Paul, and what's he doing? He's telling Timothy, I want you to appoint other men. So there's Paul, there's Timothy. I want you to appoint other men who can teach others. So you see how the Apostle Paul there is preparing for four generations into the future. Or look at the Apostle Peter. He says, I, Peter, will make every effort to see that after my departure, that is my death, you will always be able to remember these things. And so here we see the apostles making preparation for their teaching to be passed on. And again, that this is what you'd expect a teacher to do. It's not an unusual thing for a teacher to make preparation for it to be passed on. Now, I want us to move now from considering the New Testament to actually moving into other history outside of the Bible now, and particularly to look at Justin Martyr. Now, he lived from 100 AD to 165, and so that this is like two or three generations after Jesus now. And we read here that on the day called Sunday, and so he's describing what Christians do and explaining it to people who aren't Christian, and he says, on the day called Sunday, there is a gathering together at one place of all those who live in cities and in the country, and the memoirs of the apostles or the writings of the prophets are read as long as time permits. Then, when the reader has ceased, the president presents admonition and invitation to the imitation of these good things. So you see there that that this is an early account. It's not saying that they're reading from the Bible. It doesn't use that sort of modern terminology, but it's using that very ancient way of describing it. The memoirs of the apostles, the teaching of the prophets, and then somebody speaking from these. Now, again, I want to stress that what the church is doing here is continuing the practice of the Jewish synagogue that Jesus was part of. And so I'm not even asking you to believe that the church started something completely new in what they were doing. They came out of the synagogue and they're just continuing this practice as the non-Christian Jewish people were doing a similar thing, having the scriptures read and having it explained to them by their teachers. And so that's what we see happening here. Well, for a small conclusion for that section as well, the writings of the apostles were used in the churches from the start. The disciples went around, the apostles of Jesus started these churches, their teaching went to these churches, and they were just being used within these churches. In the same way, if you're familiar with the church today, that they've got their Bibles there, and they might be going through the habits of doing these things, this type of habit was actually there very early in Christianity, and it had taken this over from the Jewish religion before it. So again, I want to stress that this is actually normal and quite reasonable. And there's no need to be sceptical about it. Well, that's the first question. Where did these books come from? And hopefully you've got some idea now as to their history. My second question is, how were the books put together? Because initially, they weren't just one book. As I pointed out, the Bible is a collection of many books over a long period of time. And I want us to consider now, how did the scripture, the parts of the Bible that particularly came with Jesus, how were those bits put together? Well, to some degree, I want to say they came together naturally. They came together just by people being Christians together and sharing them with each other. And it was quite natural. As I pointed out before, the churches would pass these letters around. And again, that's not an unusual thing. I know I keep stressing that point, but I need to. The churches just passed these around. And so an apostle may have gone to one particular area and not another area. Another apostle may have gone to that area. But these churches would be in contact with each other, particularly in the Roman Empire. There was a very good communication network where things, messages and books could be passed around relatively easily. And so what we find is that just over time, the churches just share these books amongst themselves. Now, it's not that every church in every place had all of the writings of the apostles. It wasn't like that. It wasn't as neat as that. I think Christians may like it to be a bit neater than it was. But it was still good in that the churches have got a natural network. They're all they all know they're Christian, and they all know they're brothers and sisters. They've got a common faith, and so they just share things with each other. They visit each other. They help each other. You know how there are Christian aid organisations who go and take aid to difficult places and help people? Well, Christians have always been doing that. It's not something that just started in the 20th century. Christians have been doing that from the very beginning. They would go and visit churches who were in need. And there was this exchange of the teachings of the apostles amongst them. But as I said, it's not a nice, neat thing. It happened in certain regions more than in others, and somewhere where it may be right out in the back blocks, out in the villages, that they may only have a certain amount of the scripture that it had reached them. And so over time, there came the need to standardise what were the official writings that we were accepting. There are a number of reasons for this. As I said, one of them was just that the churches wanted to know what they should be having in their library. Remembering that the technology of having it all in one book wasn't there. Normally they were on scrolls or on parchments and would be a series of books, more just like a library of books, not just one book. So there was needs in order to standardise what were these books so that it can be clear. This was brought on just from the growth of the churches and people wanting to translate the books into other languages. Which ones do I translate? Which are the ones we see as authoritative? But there were also challenges. There was a man named Marcion in the year 140, and what he said was that all of the prophets before Jesus in the Old Testament were not to be accepted, and much of what we would see in the New Testament is not to be accepted, and he made his own edited list of books. Now, the church opposed him and said, no, that we accept these books. You just can't get rid of all the Jewish Old Testament books. You can't do that. And so that made them start to make a list of what books you were to have. There were, of course, also false gospels being written and false teachings. So Christianity was started in a very multicultural setting. And the teaching of Jesus was picked up and adapted by all types of people. That they liked Jesus. He was being spoken about. They liked his teaching. They took him up and mixed them up with their philosophies, and so they were happy to take on any teacher. And when Jesus comes on, well, they'll take him on. Right? And so they do. And so there are these other accounts being written with Jesus, but sort of in a different way to what the church was doing. Sometimes these were called secret gospels, which was a way of sort of showing that it was a way of explaining why no one knew of it. See, why is it that we haven't heard of this book before? Well, it was secret. So that was the reason they would give, because it was a secret one. That's why you haven't heard of it, but we've now found it. And so this was part of... You'll find a number of these books are called the Secret Teachings or something like that. We also need to realise that the Gospels started a new genre. I said that they continued the idea of scripture beforehand, but they also were distinct. And just as if you're familiar with grunge music, if you're familiar with grunge music, there was a band, was it Nirvana or someone, started grunge in such a way that other people started to imitate them. And that's just sort of what happens. And so what we have with the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, these books are becoming well known and established. And people write in that style because that's part of the genre that's just around. Okay, that's quite a normal thing. It's like letters. We write letters because that's the genre. We write emails because that's the genre. These Gospels had their own sort of style to them, which people imitated in various ways. Sometimes these other Gospels filled in the gaps. What did Jesus do when he was a child? And so they would fill in the gaps. Yes, now, another point I need to say with this is that a lot of these other Gospels, which we might call false Gospels, we need to understand that a lot of them were actually still very good, and you would accept them as a Christian. You could read them as a Christian and go, oh, I actually agree with that. I don't have any trouble with that. And so we mustn't think that there were all these Gospels and all these letters and they're all saying completely different things. From what I've been able to find out, most of them were actually written by Orthodox Christians and just filling in the gaps of Jesus' life. A number of them were written by people who were the generation after the apostles of Jesus. And so they're very close to Jesus, but they're not apostles. So the gospel of the epistle of Barnabas, or the shepherd of Hermes, you could read that as a Christian and go, yes, I agree with it. It's just that it wasn't written by an apostle. There was also persecutions. And so in the year 303, Diocletian called for the destruction of all the sacred books of the Christians. And so it was important for Christians to know which books they had to die for. And so they had to have a list of what were the authoritative ones. And so what we find is that the church councils begin to publish, or just individual churches even, it wasn't even councils, sometimes it was councils, they begin to publish lists of the books that are part of the Christian scriptures from about the 2nd to the 4th century. And they were stating publicly what Christians believed. Now, you may think that this was a question only for the later centuries of Christianity. So that in the beginning it's all nice and clear cut, and then later on there's all this teaching, and then people have got to try to sort out, oh, no, you know, it's almost like it's gone wild, and we've got to try to figure out which bits are genuine. But it wasn't like that. Part of Christian discipleship from the very beginning was to discern true and false teaching. And so this whole process of which books are in the Bible actually begins with the disciples themselves. Have a look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 to 2, which you've got in your notes there. It says, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our being gathered to him, we ask you, brothers, not to become easily unsettled or alarmed by some prophecy, report, or letter supposed to have come from us, saying that the day of the Lord has already come. Don't let anyone deceive you in any way. So it's not just that in the later centuries people were writing things and the Christians didn't know what was real, but part of being a Christian, if you were to become a Christian, part of what you get taught to do as a Christian is to discern what's true and false. And this idea that you can see here with the Apostle Paul, and the 2 Thessalonians is a very early letter in Christianity. It's one of the earlier ones that we have. We see here that he's saying, don't be alarmed by false letters. You know, make that judgment. Make sure you listen to it. And in fact, Jesus himself warns the church of not just listening to anyone, but being careful who they listen to. So Christian discipleship takes into account and has from the very beginning that there are false teachers. And people will say things that we don't automatically just accept. We need to check it. I think another important issue for us is that the issue of what books were in the Bible or the canon, and the word canon means rule or standard. The standard of the books, what books, it actually wasn't a burning issue for the church. Sometimes when it's portrayed in these documentaries, they'll talk about it in such a way as if it's a crisis for the church and the church doesn't know what to do and should they do this or should they do that. Well, there was no church council on this topic. Right? So there was no church council. It's not that they called all the leaders together and said, let's decide on the Bible. It was discussed at church councils as a secondary matter. The main issues that they had were issues on the person of Jesus and how should they understand his divinity. And we'll look at that a bit later on. But the whole question here, it actually wasn't an overwhelming problem for the church. We just need to understand. Like if you went back there, they were arguing about other things. They weren't really arguing about this. This was there, but this is like second or third down the rung. And the big issues were, how do we understand the person of Jesus from the scriptures? Not so much arguing about the scriptures, because they actually agreed a fair bit over those scriptures. Well, how did the early church leaders come to these decisions and make these lists? Well, the way they did it was by three criteria. The first was that they wanted some evidence that it was written by an apostle or somebody closely associated with an apostle. That was the first way. So it had to have this living connection to Jesus. Secondly, it had to conform to the rule of faith. By this they meant it had to agree with the gospel that they universally stood to, but also that it had to agree with the prophets who were before it, so with the Old Testament. And this was quite reasonable because Jesus was Jewish and he was speaking about those scriptures as part of his teaching. Also, the document had to have a continuous acceptance within the church at large. That is, they had to be able to investigate and say, has this document been used in your church for a long time? Can you trace it back? Is there a history of it being used? Do you have the old copies? Can you show us that this has been used here for a long time? So they were the three things. Was it written by an apostle? Did it conform to what we understood to be the truth? And does it have a history of being used? And these were the criteria that they used. Now, these issues were discussed within the church and across regions while they were already using what they had. As I said, it's not that there was a decision that was made on this and then everyone had to start using certain books. They had this discussion over hundreds of years. And all the time they were using their books. Now, how did it work itself out? Well, sorry, first I'll take a step back. Who were the people doing this? The people who were making these types of decisions were basically the bishops of the day. And they were of the majority church. So there were different groups within Christianity. Certain Jewish groups and a whole range of other groups. But the people who were doing this, long before Christians were in charge, long before the Roman Empire went Christian and had any authority over the church, the people who were doing this were just the church bishops, the leaders of the church who would get together from the majority of the church and they would discuss these things. Now, when it came to discussing the books of the New Testament, what we see is that 85% of it wasn't even discussed, because it just had a universal acceptance. These were Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, Acts, Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, 1 and 2 Timothy, Titus, 1 Peter and 1 John. Now that's about 85%. So for 85%, the churches didn't need to have any discussion because these were known to have come from the disciples. They were the rule of faith, and these were the ones that had this continuous acceptance. But books were discussed, and I think this is where, as Christians, we mustn't exaggerate it. So I'm not going to say to you that it was all 100% nice, clear-cut. No, 85% of it was like that. 15% of it wasn't. 15% wasn't. And so there were 15% of the books required further discussion to clarify their genuineness. As I said before, not all the books had made it to every region. It just hadn't happened that way. And so books like Hebrews, it had been used from a very early date, but its authorship was not proved convincingly. So even though they got these three criteria, that it's not an exact thing they're doing, but they discuss it and work it out as best they can. Hebrews was very ancient. They could see that. It had this continuous practice within the church. It's just that they weren't as sure who wrote it. You'll see sometimes people say it was the Apostle Paul, but I don't think it was him. I think we're not sure. But it just has that early, it's very early in the Hebrew tradition. There's James. People weren't sure about James. It was very old. In fact, it was exceptionally old, but people felt that it conflicted with Paul's letters in the way that James says, you're saved not by faith alone, but by works. And people were saying, well, that doesn't sound like it fits with Paul. But Paul wasn't the criteria for everything. But people often say, well, they were making it just to reflect the Apostle Paul. But James didn't sit easily with Paul. But they knew that he was the disciple, the brother of Jesus. They knew it had been used from of old. And so he was in, even though it didn't sit easily. I think it does, but that's another thing. 2 Peter, the questions that were asked there were that, well, 2 Peter has a very different style of the Greek. If you read the Greek of 1 Peter, it reads in one way. You read the Greek of 2 Peter, it's very different. And so they said, well, two completely different styles. Now, if you read 1 Peter, you'll actually find out that he didn't write it at all. He gets Silas to write it because Peter couldn't write Greek. So they obviously kept it in because they realised yes, it's very different, but he's probably got a different scribe writing it for that occasion. 1 and 2 John were just not quoted much by the early church. And so when they looked back to say, you know, when we look at our history, were the books of 1 and 2 John quoted much? And they weren't. But I want to ask you, are they quoted much today? They're not, like, they're just very small letters. And yes, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, Romans, they're quoted. We can see the continuous use of them within the history of the church. But 2 and 3 John, they're just not often quoted much, even today. And so, but people discuss that. Jude and Revelation, it was interesting that they were used early but then fell into disuse. Apparently Jude because it quotes the book of Enoch and people didn't like that. And interestingly, in the Syrian Orthodox Church, they didn't accept, and they still don't accept, the book of Revelation because they felt it caused too much trouble. And so that was how they made their decision. Now, I've given you some bibliographies where you could follow that up. Now, I just wanted to look at a quick point here, and that is to revisit Constantine again, because the argument of Constantine and the emperor, the Council of Nicaea, often comes up. And this argument, you find it in the Da Vinci Code. You just find it being quoted in all manner of places where people say that the Bible was made at the Council of Nicaea. So this is in the early 4th century. And it was Emperor Constantine who wanted to bring uniformity to his kingdom. And so he got the bishops together and said, this is going to be the Bible, Jesus is now God, and burn everything else. And you'll hear that. What you'll never actually get, though, with those claims is any evidence. It is just absolute fiction. The Council of Nicaea is by the 4th century, and Christians are taking meticulous notes by the 4th century. You can go back to books called the Early Church Fathers, which are about this many. I mean, it's a CD these days, but it's these volumes of books, and they record every council, they record everything in it. They record all the laws that came out of it, the canons that came out of it. And you can go to the Council of Nicaea, and this just did not happen. This just did not happen. Yes, Constantine did help in the production of Bibles, but the process that happened here was the continuing process that had already begun hundreds of years before, and that was of them finalising and recognising the books that they were already using. And so when that comes up, we need to understand that it's fiction and that Constantine didn't do that. Constantine did have an influence in that now the emperor was behind Christianity. Christians could now afford bigger Bibles, and so this is when we start to get some very big Bibles. I think there's one called the Sinaiticus, the Codex Sinaiticus, which is probably one that Constantine had made. And it's a complete Bible, and it would have cost, you know, an absolute fortune. But you needed a king to get behind you to do that. Another problem about the whole Constantine theory is that people put too much weight on the Roman Church. One of the problems we have is that we forget about the church that existed from Syria right across into India at this time. People keep thinking that Christianity is Roman Catholic or something. You need to understand that the Roman Catholic Church was only a small part of the church in these centuries. A good third of the church were in Africa. Not a whole third, but a good third would have been between Syria and India. Unfortunately, that got wiped out by the jihad, but that's another story. But up and before the jihad, you had a lot of Christians going across there. There was great freedom for them within the Persian Empire. There were some persecutions, but by and large, they could get out and do what they wanted to do over there. And the important thing about the Persian Empire between Syria and India is that it's not under Roman control. And so any decision that Constantine made has got nothing to do with that region. It's got nothing to do with the Christians over there. Those Christians live under a different king. They live under a Zoroastrian Persian king. And so the idea that Constantine could standardise the Bible for every Christian is just false, because he doesn't control every Christian. There's a good third of Christianity outside of his control. And we actually see that today, and this might make you feel a little uncomfortable, But not all New Testaments around the world are actually the same. If you go to the Syrian Orthodox Church, so this is a church in Syria, they don't have the book of Revelation, as I said. Now, you might feel a little uncomfortable about that, but I actually think that's a good thing as well, because it shows that no one stomped on them to make them have it. They had their list of books that they worked out as a church. If you go to Ethiopia, they have a few extra books in their New Testament. Books about how to baptize and how to do certain things. Now again, that might make you feel a little uncomfortable. How is it that they have extra books than us? Well, again, it's because there has been no iron fist coming down. So in one sense, it might make us feel a little uncomfortable. On the other sense, it's evidence of no iron fist. And so there is no, like, we need to understand that when the Christians are getting together and formulating which books to have, this is being worked out just in normal discussion between the churches. Yes, the emperor helped in financing it from the 4th century onwards, but his power was limited. It certainly wasn't over all the Christians. And if we look at the canons that exist today and go right back to the origin of those churches, we see that they were independent and they made up their own mind. So there is no conspiracy. There is no conspiracy. There is no evidence of conspiracy here. In fact, the evidence is of the opposite. Now, I want to look now at some... Oh, sorry, I'll make some concluding comments. So to conclude this section, 85% of the New Testament was already universally agreed upon and wasn't even discussed in these discussions. But 15% was, and we need to admit that. I'm not going to exaggerate it for you, that there were some books that were. The different churches and regions had to convince each other on the authority of a few books. And these decisions may have been enforced at a local level, but they weren't enforced at an international level. There was no central church government to enforce any decision over all of Christendom or over all Christians. And that's why we still have small differences today. And so I want us to avoid exaggerating in either direction. For Christians who want to exaggerate and say, this book has had no questions asked, everything is just simple, it's all just straightforward, it just fell from heaven and there it was. It didn't happen like that. But we can't exaggerate the other way. And that is, it happened the normal way that teaching gets passed around. And that is that it gets the teacher sends out his disciples pass the teaching around. Over a period of time, that gets collected together. A few questions are asked about some of it, but then it gets formalized into its final form. And that's just what happened. So we can't exaggerate either way. And the people who want to exaggerate and say, because you can ask any question of the New Testament, because a question was asked, therefore you've got to write the whole lot off, that's just ridiculous. Just because you can ask a question about some doesn't mean you can extend it to write the whole lot off. That's just, you'd have nothing from the ancient world if you were to do that. You'd have nothing from even today if you're going to do that. There's always a few questions. That's to be expected. And the good thing is you can still go and look at those questions being asked and go, okay, let's have a look at Hebrews. Let's have a look at Revelation. You're still able to do that. I want us to look now at a rejected book, the Gospel of Thomas. So you can sort of see the types of decisions they were making when they said, no, we don't have this book. Because I think it's helpful for us to do that. So you're more familiar with the Gospels in the Bible and the letters that are already in the Bible. What about the ones that weren't? So I thought we'll finish up by having a look at this. Now, this is called the Gospel of Thomas. It's not really a gospel. I think people call it a gospel. I don't think it calls itself that, because it's just sayings of Jesus. The Gospels of Jesus actually have the doings of Jesus, the things that he did and his sayings. So it's not really a gospel in that sense, but it's taken on that name. It was discovered in Egypt, in what's called the Nag Hammadi Library. All right, well, first of all, with the authorship, it does carry the name Thomas. And so that was one part of it. It carries that name. But beyond that name, we don't have any other evidence for where it's come from. When we look at the teaching within it, and I've given you some quotes there, you'll see that it sort of has summary statements from elsewhere in the Bible. So look at verse 93 from the Gospel of Thomas. It said, Jesus said, why do you wash the outside of the cup? And why do you think that he who made the inside, do you not think that he who made the inside made the outside also? Now, that's quite similar to what we have already in the Gospel of Matthew and I think Luke. And so there's that type of thing there. Or Jesus said, come to me, for my yoke is excellent and my authority sweet, and you will find rest for yourselves. So again, that's from the Gospel of Matthew there. And maybe both of them went back to a common tradition. But then we find that there's only a few of those verses there. And because they're not set in the context of Jesus actually speaking it, they're more just like the verses that have been taken out of that context, if you can understand what I mean. So it's not just here's what Jesus was doing and here's what Jesus said as a whole story, but this is just a bit of that story taken out. But then we find Greek ideas, Greek philosophical ideas. Look at verse 20. Jesus said, blessed is the man who existed before he came into being. Now, that's an interesting idea, isn't it? You haven't read that in the Bible, that we existed before we came into being. But that's a very Greek idea of the eternal spirit coming down into this world. In fact, when we look at the rest of the books that were found with the Gospel of Thomas, it's quite telling. So the Nag Hammadi Library had the other books that were in it were a paraphrase of Shem, which is a Jewish writing. There was Plato's Republic. There was this Zostriasnos, the largest book, and the Discourse on the 8th and 9th, the writings of Hermes. Now, a lot of those are straight Greek philosophy, and so it's interesting to look just where the Gospel of Thomas comes from, that it's not coming from really a Christian library, it's coming from a Greek philosophical library of books. Have a look at verse 118, though. Simon Peter says to them, when he says them, it's speaking to Jesus and the group. It says, let Mary go out from our midst, for women are not worthy of life. Jesus said, see, I will draw her so to make her male, so that she also may become a living spirit like you males. For every woman who has become male will enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, this is where the church would look at that and say, well, that doesn't really fit into pretty well anything we believe. Okay, now again, see the authorship thing, it's not that each of these is absolute, but when you take them all together, we don't really know where this guy came from. The authorship doesn't seem to be authenticated anywhere. Yes, there are some bits of Jesus' teaching in it, but it's got a lot of Greek ideas in it, a lot of Greek philosophy in it. And when we read this, you know, what does the Bible say? Well, the rest of the Bible says it doesn't matter if you're male or female. In Christ, you're made to be part of God's people. So you see that idea in Galatians chapter 3, verses 26 to 29, where it specifically says, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. And when you read the Gospels, Jesus is giving life to women, isn't he? The first witnesses in the Gospel, in the Gospels, are women. And so when you read here, Jesus, you know, saying, well, women can't go to the kingdom of heaven, that only men can, that only men are worthy of life, that is so far removed from Moses and David, like from everything, isn't it? So I think that when you look at this, you've just got to look at the book and you say, well, that actually just doesn't fit with the Christian message at all. Now again, it's not an absolute thing, but when you consider authorship, the content, the fact that this was only known in one small place, you think, no, this isn't from Jesus. And that's how they came to these types of decisions. This is similar with other ones like the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of Mary that you hear about. But one of the things I want to point out is, and before I move on to the next point, we must realise that a lot of these other writings that weren't accepted were actually quite Christian, and they weren't hidden. So I've got them here. This is called the Early Christian Writings, and these are books that never made it into the New Testament, but are still thoroughly Christian. And so you can go buy this. This is just published by Penguin. So the idea that the church suppressed all these books, and if it didn't make it into the Bible, we just got rid of them all. Maybe for some of them, they suppressed them. And you didn't actually really need to burn them. You just had to say, don't copy them. It's very expensive to make a book in the ancient world. And if people just stopped copying them, they just disappeared. The ones that we have, which are even beyond what's in the Bible, were the ones that were copied. And so you've got, let me just read you the titles we've got here. So there's the Epistle of Barnabas, the Shepherd of Hermes, the Didache, a whole range of letters, the First Epistle of Clement to the Corinthians. All of these were ones that were also discussed. And my point being here is, they're not burnt. They're not, you can still go get them and have a read of them. And a lot of them are thoroughly Christian. It's just they weren't written by an apostle, and we knew that, so they didn't make it into the Bible. But this question, and I'm going to finish up here, the question of the canon, it's not one that actually goes away. You might think it's a question for right back there and then, but it's not, because you've got this one called the Gospel of Barnabas. Now, this was written by a Muslim in the 14th century to show that Jesus predicted the coming of Muhammad. And there's another one that the Muslims wrote in 1979 called the Gospel According to Islam. And the man just says straight out that he's transformed the Gospels to complement the Gospels and to make a new Gospel and to transform it according to the Quran. And Muslims, if you know a Muslim and you go to an Islamic bookshop, they're making a question. They're saying to you, you need to include this in your Bible. And as I said, there's no ancient evidence for this book. There's no evidence for it being used in antiquity. There is an old Gospel of Barnabas next to the Epistle of Barnabas, but there's no other evidence at all for this book. And so there are no scholars who accept that this is anything. In fact, it has technology from centuries later on. I won't go into that. There's, of course, the Book of Mormon, isn't there? You see, the Mormons come around. I saw them on campus the other day, and they're saying to you, this is Scripture. And so it's not just a question for back there and then. It's a question for you as a Christian now to be discerning the truth, to be thinking about what is true. I've got to be thinking here as a Christian. Now, we're not making exactly the same decisions that the early Christians made, but they're not making the decisions that we're having to make either. They're not having to make the decision over the Gospel of the Book of Mormon. They're not having to make the decision over this, because these books came thousands of years later. They had their decisions to make, and you've actually, it's now your role as a Christian to be making your decision on these. I saw another one on Amazon. There was Jesus and Buddha, parallel sayings. And this person was showing how Jesus and Buddha were basically the same at all these points. And it's trying to put forward a Buddhist idea of Jesus. Now, these are the decisions the early church had to make. When they saw Jesus and Buddha being put together, right? They saw it with Greek philosophy and Jesus being put together. They made their decision. They were able to do it in, I guess, the same way you're able to pick it, aren't you? You can pick it. When someone says Jesus and Buddha, you can pick it. When the Mormons come, you can pick it. You can pick it. And that's the types of decisions they were making. So I want to encourage us not to be given over to the conspiracy theories. There's just no evidence for those conspiracy theories. The information about how the Bible was put together is actually very open. And you can investigate it. And for most of it, it's clear cut. There's some of it where we've got some questions that can be asked. But the main thing where I wanted to finish was just by saying, we actually can have great confidence in this. We can be very confident that what we have in the Bible are the teachings of Jesus and his disciples as they pass them on. And there's no reason for us to be sceptical. And for those of us who are Christian, I'd like to finish by saying, we can actually be really thankful that the early Christians wrote these things down and were careful to pass them on and to pass the truth of the gospel on for future generations like us, so that we can have it here. And I want to encourage you that when you're living in a world of the Gospel of Barnabas and the Quran and the Book of Mormon and all these other false scriptures, that you too will take a stand for the truth and make sure that you pass on the truth for the next generation. Thank you.